The people in Bolivia have requested that we record this, and I forgot to do it last week. And I forgot to start it up again after our break. So I am sorry that we have not recorded the first 5 minutes of our second half. But
cut that part out and pretend that we took a long break.
Okay,
we.
You missed nothing. It's okay.
I was going to say, I mean, Ido's sort of suggestion was that somehow before you get to the point of deciding on distributional issues that are presumably somewhat zero-sum in nature, you would have decided on some set of criteria that you would use to decide on those distributions. At least that's what I took your point.
Well, the criteria for deciding any sort of issue.
But the problem is that any set of criteria presumably are going to have consequences for how distributional issues are going to be decided. At the moment that you are deciding on, it's sort of a social contract kind of problem. There's never a before where you decide on the meta contract that enables you to decide on the issues, right? So I think it's a somewhat more intractable problem. I don't know what the solution is, but.
Well, I think you can have deliberation on something. Well, what I had in mind, I guess, in the back of my head was something like a Rawlsian difference principle that you can deliberate about and agree to as a guiding principle for making decisions with regard to distribution. I think you can do that. I don't think there's any, you know.
The problem, the Rawlsian
idea. It doesn't have to be that. You know,
the Rawlsian idea for these kinds of things simplifies it to one dimension, right?
So, I know. I just mean it as an example.
Right.
Yeah.
So we've got several different ideas here. One is that you establish a clear enough set of principles prior to making a decision that then in the deliberation you can ask to what extent does one priority or another match these principles. My guess is that it's pretty rare to be able to find either enough agreement on the principles or enough agreement on how given policies match those principles for the logical structure of that position to work, that is to actually give you an answer. But nevertheless, being clear upon the values that you're trying to accomplish could certainly facilitate this. Catherine's view was essentially that there should not be, you want to minimize the sense in which there are winners and losers whenever there is a conflict that cannot itself be resolved by trying to find ways in which whoever loses on some particular agenda item nevertheless gets their priorities met in some other way. Another language for that is that you try to find compromises. So, you know, that you have opposing interests, and rather than just simply have one win and one lose, in a deliberative democratic context, you try to figure out ways in which you somehow or other compromise that conflict so that you don't have such sharp divisions. Now, the premise of that is, of course, that compromise is possible. And if in the Marxist tradition, one of the classic assumptions is that so long as there are really classes in play, as long as there are antagonistic interests, and that's why the word antagonistic has bite in these contexts, as long as you have antagonistic interests, compromises simply reflect balances of power, balances of force. So you can have compromises, and you know, you have stalemates in a battle in which then the territory is divided because neither side can win, but it's just a kind of balance of force that defines the compromise. In theories of deliberative democracy, the notion of compromise has a lot more to do with each party listening to the other and trying to empathize with the interests that are not their own, and therefore discovering ways in which something other than complete victory or complete defeat advances the interests of otherwise conflicting parties. In the specific case of participatory budgeting, if the time horizon is long enough, if this year we know we're going to be doing it next year and the year after, so that people are confident in the longer time horizon under which these priorities are being set, then what happens in effect is people who don't have their priorities met in one particular year have some prior claim to their priorities being given more weight the next round, so that over time there's less winners and losers and more a distribution of winning and losing depending upon what the particular issues are. You know, so if the soccer club wants improvements in the recreational fields, and the mothers want daycare centers provided for children, and they argue about it, the kind of compromise that occurs is to say it's more pressing to have the daycare facilities now because our kids exist now. We'll prioritize that. But the soccer, football that should be, not soccer, the football field will be a priority in some manner or other in the, you know, in subsequent rounds. So compromise is one element of this. Articulating common principles even in the context of conflicting interests. Because you can have conflicting interests with common principles. The fact that your interests are opposed doesn't mean you can't share criteria. It's just the criteria work differently for different people. But there's a third idea, which is probably a little less familiar, I think, which is an idea that is stressed in a certain philosophical tradition in the United States associated with what's called pragmatism as a philosophical position around these things, which does not take it as given that we know what our interests are until we deliberate. So we have some very general sense of our interests, but we don't have a specific sense of what is indeed our interests. And partially that's because we don't know who the we is. That is, we have interests, but what your interests are depends upon who you're including in the circle of people whose needs you're taking into account.
And that doesn't get constituted until deliberation begins.
Well, it gets reconstituted. You know, it's a dialectical process. You come in with a certain sense of your interests and of the we that defines those interests, and then you engage in deliberation over solving problems, and in the course of that you discover new forms of commonality and new forms of pain and hopes that other people have, and in the course of that your sense of what the we is and what the interests are evolve and develop out of deliberation. And so the allocation of resources to satisfy goals, let's say, evolves through deliberation rather than entering with fixed interests and then fighting it out to get resources for it. Now, I think all of these things go on. I think there's voting and bargaining. I'll do this for you this year, you do that for me next year. There's a compromise, we come to some middle ground. And there's the discovery of new interests. I think all of these things occur in a deliberative process. And that's the goal. I mean, that's the ideal. This is the utopian ideal, if you will, of empowered participatory governance, of which the participatory budget would be one example, where that's the kind of process through which priorities get set, as opposed to a form of process by which priorities get set in which people bring power which they have outside of the deliberative arena to bear on getting their way in the decision making by making threats, for example. You know, including physical threats but also economic threats.
And I think though that the question of
Catherine.
Okay. That the question of stability is really important, because you can't imagine making long term planning unless you know that there's always, like, if we're arguing about something and we have a solution that we'll both ultimately benefit from in the long run, if we don't think we're gonna make it to the long run, there's no point in us like picking that, solutioning towards that, and we should just keep fighting because really that'll work better. So I think the stability of the context in which these deliberations take place is a really important factor on which that process hinges.
Charity.
So being optimistic, if we get to this point of the real utopian, right, so we destroyed capitalism somehow, so how would that change, right, so how would that change reflect the difference in a participatory budget setting, because I imagine it's more about resources rather than money and funds, and that I don't know, some different laws are somehow governing it. It's governing how, you know, how things are distributed at the national level and then how they get distributed at the community level. So I don't know, how would that be different from looking at like Brazil right now within the capitalist system, locally and nationally and internationally? But
well, presumably if capitalist class relations were marginalized, I mean, disappeared completely, it's another thing. But let's suppose that capitalism is no longer the defining the dynamics of the economic structure. So one thing that means is that the participants within a deliberative process of this sort will be deliberating on more egalitarian basis. That the kind of class divisions which get fueled by capitalism will be much weaker. And as actors enter a collective political decision-making process on more equal terms with each other, then I think the conflicts of interest will be less sharp. So one, the Marxian, I think, fantasy about the withering away of the state, you know, that sort of vision, is that if classes disappear, then you don't need any conflict resolution, coercive conflict resolution, because consensus will be easy to forge just through discussion. So, I mean, that's the fantasy why you don't need rules any longer that are imposed, rules that have coercive power behind them, because consensus will be spontaneous and simply a matter of clarifying information is the sort of view, because everybody will share the same interest. Well, that's totally implausible to me, that there will be conflicts of interest. But if people enter decision-making contexts in which there is a conflict of interest, but they have an equality of standing, then I think the possibility of compromise, discovering new solutions, all of that becomes easier. There's fewer constraints imposed on that. And also, I think the simple fact that there's more resources available for collective decisions enormously changes the nature of conflict itself. Just speaking from the a very limited democratic decision-making context, academic departments. In years when, at the University of Wisconsin, we've had lots of money because the state was providing us with lots of resources, and we would be hiring two or three faculty members every year, there was very little conflict between the different wings of the department over who to hire, because one group's hiring someone didn't foreclose another group hiring. Once you hit sharp scarcity and you hire one person every other year, then the stakes get very high and it becomes harder to find compromise. You know, it's an obvious point, but I think it applies to urban budgets as well as to sociology departments.
When was it exactly the state was lavishly funding?
In the 70s and 80s, we hired, two or three people a year, mostly. This idea that interests are not fixed but endogenous to the process is, I think, needs to be given more weight than it often is. And indeed, in the participatory budget, there are indications that people actually eventually began to approach the problem that way. That is, you approach the arena of the assembly saying, there's certain things I'd like to see happen, but I'm really interested in what everybody else wants to see happen. It's not that that's just going to get in the way of me getting my way. It's that I'm really interested because they may have some priorities that I hadn't thought of, which are even better for our collective life as members of a community, in which I care about your well-being and your interests being satisfied, not just my own. Well, that has to do with the sense of who the we is. You know, if the we includes all of you, then I do care what you want, because I can't weigh the priorities properly until I know what you want. That's the kind of ideal. That's what you want to achieve a form of participation and solidarity in which that's what you're trying to achieve. Of course, in a city that's riven by inequalities and poverty and crime and all these other things that was true in Porto Alegre, that ideal is not generally achieved. But I think there was some movement towards it so that conflicts were not universally seen as zero-sum with winners and losers, as opposed to problems to be solved with as much collaboration and as much movement towards consensus as possible. Any reactions from the Southern Hemisphere to this set of issues?
I was thinking the difficulty of export these experiences without taking consideration of the specific context, historic context, in which they happen. I think the most important question is why it could have success in Porto Alegre and why it didn't have in Buenos Aires. Comparing those processes, you can have a diagnostic of the mechanisms itself.
That's a good paper topic.
That's a good paper topic. Let me make just two comments on that problem. One, the conditions under which a institutional innovation like this originates are much more demanding than the conditions under which they can be copied. That is, it took a very special set of historical conditions in Porto Alegre at a particular historical moment that is coming out of the dictatorship, where new institutions had to be built. They had to do something. The old institutions were a mess. They had to build new institutions. And so there was a kind of institutional flexibility for innovation and to invent something new that doesn't happen all the time. Once it worked, however, and was established as a design, and once they worked through many of the flaws of the initial efforts, so they actually had a refined model, not just a crude model, then it could be copied much more widely. In Brazil itself, it's been copied in many cities. 30 or 40 cities have adopted participatory budgets. In some of them, it's been a catastrophe, a complete mess. In some of them, it's been a source of new devices for corruption. But in others, it's been quite successful. So there's a lot of variation. And the ones in which it was successful were not necessarily the ones that looked most like Porto Alegre. That is, it isn't the case that they somehow matched the special conditions of Porto Alegre. There are multiple pathways by which it could be successfully copied, even if there were very few pathways by which it could be initially invented. And there are places in Europe as well now which are trying out participatory budgeting, and I gather in other countries in Latin America there are various cities that have adopted various elements of participatory budgeting. So it seems to me a very important question, but it's not as simple that unless you have these very ideal conditions to invent it, you wouldn't be able to copy it as well. In some of the places where it hasn't succeeded, it's been because it was not fully implemented. That is, many forms of participatory budgeting are just advisory. They don't actually give the participatory assemblies power. They simply constitute a popular assembly to, in effect, make suggestions about budgets. I think the key element in the Porto Alegre case was that these councils, these assemblies, really did have power. they really did control the city budget. And the fact that they were really empowered contributed to the seriousness with which ordinary citizens took these assemblies as something to put time and energy into.
So what was the occasion for the Citizens' Assembly in BC?
The occasion for the Citizens' Assembly in British Columbia was a general dissatisfaction by both of the main parties with the existing electoral system, because it was generating huge swings in parliamentary majorities, a lot of political instability in British Columbia.
But it's been like that for a long time.
It was.
We just needed the Pope to tell us.
Well, so the instability was pretty chronic, and then it reached some kind of tipping point in which then an initiative from the Premier, in which he ran on the electoral campaign that we are going to change the electoral system, and then he didn't want to let Parliament do the changing because fearing that
partisan.
Yeah, that it would just be too partisan, and it wouldn't have the legitimacy. So when he won the election by a very big mandate, although not by a huge majority, it's just the electoral districts were so evenly balanced that winning every electoral district by a couple of percentage gave him 70 out of 80 or whatever.
Oh, he was from the NDP.
No, it wasn't the NDP. It was the
Liberal.
It was not the NDP. It was I'm not sure if it was the Liberals or the Progressive Conservatives or whatever they're called.
Just conservative.
Isn't there this Progressive Conservative?
Yeah, it used to be.
Okay.
But it might have been Reform Party then.
The Reform? No, not in 2004. That was Martin in 2004.
This is provincial.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at the provincial level.
Okay, but this is a secondary matter to the grand historical questions. look, we have 25 minutes left. Maybe we should turn to the Ricardo challenge. That all of this is simply a diversion from the serious business of challenging the bourgeois regime, as stated in the interrogation, and that these kinds of reforms, however nice they might seem on certain criteria, nevertheless strengthen the existing system and do not constitute significant moves in the direction of a more socially empowered form of institutions, and thus they are not moves in the direction of emancipation. So that's my summary of your position. If you want to elaborate, you have the floor for...
Yes, I would like to make a little bit clearer my thoughts, because what you wrote down in the agenda, I don't think that this is accurately what I thought about that topic. I think that these democratic reforms could mean a big difference, but I don't understand why you name them as radical or emancipatory, because I think that radical or emancipatory democracy would mean that every person could participate in the public affairs, and that implies that that would imply that a lot of circumstances would have to be achieved before. And I don't know if I was clear.
Yeah, that's clear.
Ah, okay. My question was: are these formal mechanisms? I think that these are formal mechanisms rather than emancipatory mechanisms. because as far as there will be difference of classes, and as far as there will be poverty and unemployment, and people would have to work 10 hours a day, and people would have to think about how, if they got money to live or not, it is very difficult to build a real democracy. How can I say? This reminds me the classical idea of the reformism about that if we make little changes and little reforms, this will encourage more reforms and so on, and there will come a time that capitalism will be all reform and will be built a real democracy, and this doesn't take into account that a radical change must be done so as to achieve this real democracy.
Rodolfo, do you want to add to that? You had similar.
I tried to play with the concept that you set up in the introduction, like desirability and viability, and like if we and I tried to expand desirability as something that actually would imply I want to read it because the some changes that would generate a cumulative transformation of the system. So maybe it would be a step not that far as Ricardo was saying. I was implying, okay, if we accept that there could be some a gradual transformation, and if this is the desirability, so I was saying maybe the institutions that actually can bring more radical changes within this society are the less viable. So we have to keep with institutions like the democratic CICAR that I didn't see as changing that much, or the assemblies. So I was thinking maybe the cases are constrained by this, but that these the more desirable cases are the less viable. So in that sense, it's similar to Ricardo. And I was thinking historically, like, how can you change a country? For example, I was thinking in Bolivia recently, in the classical way of social movement plus political parties, how, like, the masses, the indigenous masses, historically discriminated, try to get into the political system and do like more or less radical reforms, and try to oppose that to this kind of institutions to build. So I don't know if so radical changes could be achieved in a country like Bolivia, for example, with so big ethnic and class difference, so strong class differentiation and inequalities. What can you achieve with these institutions? Or that was some side comment that I had.
No one has any response to these.
Wait, but your last comment is you were asking whether something like, say, that the Punto Alegre, the participatory budgeting, if that can be done in a place like Bolivia.
No, like comparing two ways of social transformation, say the classical like social movement, political party, getting into the state in order to achieve some more radical inclusion of
But what are they? What are they going to? So the question you have to answer. So the question: what are they going to do when they get in the state? So you have a social movement. So it wins. Yeah. It gets power. What is it going to do? So is it?
It's to nationalize natural gas.
Yeah, but no. But as a general matter, one. You know, we'll discuss this specifically when we approach the problem of logics of transformation. So one view is that it's really all or nothing. You either have to smash the existing system and then build, or there's no point, because unless you really solve these problems of capitalist power and social inequality, those are so constraining. They're not just constraining, but they're so constraining that until they are destroyed, then you can't make any significant headway on anything else you care about. That's the ruptural view of transformation, and the ruptural view of transformation then brings with it a skepticism about building new institutional forms prior to such a rupture. The alternative view is that in order for ruptures to have the effects and the desirable consequences we would like, they can only be successful if they've occurred after a process of institution building where you try as best as you can to build the forms. You know, institutional designs mean formal in the sense that it's the design properties we're talking about, that at least have some of the crucial elements we want to see in the society we want to build. Because otherwise, the task of rupture is just too big. The rupture has to accomplish too many changes, and it's simply impossible to achieve. The history of ruptures have not been that great as to what they actually generate, and so there's at least some evidence that building institutions in the process of struggling for change, which can only mean reform in the sense that you're actually reforming existing ways of doing things, is part of the process of eventual ruptural change. That's an alternative view to the smash first, build later view. So my defense of these reforms as being radical is not that they by themselves in this world accomplish radical democracy. I don't think it's possible to have radical democracy in capitalism. I think it's mutually inconsistent, because capitalism does block democracy from doing all sorts of things that democracy has to do if it's radical democracy. So I don't believe radical democracy is possible. I don't believe emancipation is possible inside of capitalism. But that doesn't mean that I also don't believe. That's a double negative. So it's. But I also believe. Say it positively rather than double negatively. I also believe that it is indeed possible to embody in our existing practices principles of radical democracy that are not just illusions. They're not just symbolic. They prefigure alternative institutional designs on a larger scale. And they make a difference in the lives of people that are not just superficial. So the participatory budget in Porto Alegre built daycare centers throughout the favelas where they had not existed before. They put indoor plumbing and sewers and paved streets in the parts of the city which had been neglected for forever. And produced a more egalitarian conditions of life in the infrastructure of the city than had previously existed. Now you can say that's not very important. You can particularly say that's not very important if you don't live there, you know, if you live in the nicer parts of the city. But it was it was significant to me that this was done through popular participation in the actual allocations and decisions, not done by a top-down, educated elite that seized control over the urban planning department and said, yes, we want to give the poor these things. It was done through a participatory bottom-up process, which then, to me, teaches people that there are alternative ways of doing things, not just alternative ways of getting things. And that's why I consider the participatory budget a radical experiment. It embodies principles that you would want to see in the post-capitalist emancipated future. And it doesn't just embody them in a kind of symbolic and formal way. It embodies them in a way that actually does empower people under the limits and constraints of what's possible, which are severe. So, well, you know, and I mean, that's why I think that it is appropriate to see these as social empowerment in the direction of an emancipatory transformation, even if they themselves don't achieve by themselves social emancipation.
I think there's also a slight danger in people having the, I don't want to say illusion, but coming to the understanding that they can change things within the current system. But, you know, we have to keep in mind some idea of level. Well, those roads should have been fixed, those sidewalks should have been fixed a long time ago. Like, so, you know, how much empowerment is that? And I think when we talk about rupture, when we talk about, you know, the system has to be smashed in order to continue such projects, I think there are different, we have to think of different forms of rupture, and there are different kind of extremes. So if we think about all-out revolution, right, versus, you know, what perhaps Venezuela has done, they came, a different interest came to power through democratic election, and now they're actually making institutional changes, you know, more along the lines of what we're discussing here. So I think there are different ways to think about rupture, but I definitely am of the idea that there has to be some kind of rupture for that change, because it switches people's mind instead of thinking about, well, what's possible within our current system to how do we change a system so we can start doing what we actually want to do. That's all I have to say about the rupture.
Well, we're going to have an entire session on ruptural transformation. So we will definitely embrace that topic as a focus. Yeah. Oh, I thought you were raising your hand. It's very dangerous to raise your hand, you know. We see everything you do.
Big brother, right here.
I mean, okay, well, in line with what you're saying, or and not necessarily for or against the ruptural thing, but I think that in thinking about larger, like, grand change, that I think social empowerment is, like, absolutely necessary, especially at least more social empowerment than exists now. So I think that could be a credential for gauging these programs, as if they increase social empowerment, which it seems that the budget thing does do, at least to, like, get people thinking about, like, outside the box, get people thinking that they're engage in the larger community and that mode of thinking.
Definitely, I agree with you, but, like, with the budgetary example, we still have to consider who's creating the discussions, who's creating the realm of possibilities,
yeah.
Right? So that's where we run into the question of, well, is this social empowerment to only to a limited extent? And so, you know, where's the possibility for much more deeper empowerment versus the kind of a shallow empowerment? And if there's other groups determining the agendas, determining the realm of possibilities, that's still limited while possibly giving a false illusion of full empowerment.
Now, in the meetings of the participatory budget, and I'm relying, just so you know, I'm relying on Jean-Paul Biocchi, who was a graduate student here who did his dissertation on Porto Alegre. So very little of my information is firsthand, although I did attend a bunch of meetings and somebody interpreted in my ear, but this comes from him. There was a tension within these budgetary assemblies and in the budget councils, which is where the real work did. There was a tension between political activists who constantly wanted to push the assemblies beyond their mandate, mm-hmm. who wanted them to become centers for challenging the broader structures of power and inequality, and people who said, let's get on with business and solve these problems which we're capable of solving. And that was a continual tension. It was further fueled by the fact that the style of engagement of many of the more radical people was very sectarian. You know, they tried to pack meetings, to take over leadership, you know, to do the sorts of things that vanguardist parties have always done, which then generate huge amounts of cleavage and infighting.
And don't reflect democratic functioning either.
Certainly don't reflect their capacity to actually persuade people that they're right. It's an attempt to use power rather than persuasion and deliberation as the basis for gaining control over institutions. The left, of course, is notorious in its capacity for self-destructive infighting. And one of the occasions for that is there being a kind of one illusion versus another illusion. So on the one hand, it is an illusion that with the systems of power and inequality and economic structures intact, it's an illusion to imagine that you could transform the fundamental conditions of life of ordinary people. Those constraints are real. That's an illusion. But it's equally an illusion that by an act of energy and voluntary will, you can smash the system. And that you can't do the, and that you can do that simply by outmaneuvering, you know, the masses who have false consciousness because they don't understand this, right? So there's illusions on both sides. My experience, limited as it is that the illusion of the intransigent revolutionary militants, that their illusions are more destructive in these contexts than the illusions of the reformists. That is, the illusion that you can do too much under the existing system is actually less destructive because you get a lot done, and then you bump up against limits, which shows to people the necessity of deeper change. Whereas the illusions that you can do everything means you don't get anything, or you get less done, and people get burned out, and they believe that this is all la-la land. You know, that it's people creating illusions about of grandeur. So I think there's a deep tension in any case. In the Porto Alegre case, the Workers' Party internally embodied this tension. The Workers' Party was animated in the 1980s before it took power by, you know, all sorts of groups who were combining sort of romantic revolutionaries with labor activists, with the landless movement. I mean, all sorts of different impulses came together in the Workers' Party. When the participatory budget was first imagined, as what I'm told is that the mayor and his the other leadership of the party, they basically saw this as sort of permanent revolution, a kind of Trotskyist-inspired dual power system, where they were creating a parallel state. The idea of the participatory budget is that it would be a people state alongside the bourgeois state of the city government, a kind of parallel state with dual power. That was the kind of initial impulse. And I think the inspiration of that impulse is what led to actually very creative institution building. You know, because quickly they saw that they actually could accomplish something, but not if they saw their task as destroying the existing state structure of Porto Alegre, but rather creating a countervailing source of power which would legitimate a pretty big redistribution of the resources that were available, without, of course, fundamentally challenging the overall structure of the economy. One other little historical anecdote, which is pretty interesting. After the participatory budget had been around for, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, Ford Motor Company was deciding to where it was going to site a factory in Brazil and getting cities to bid against each other for tax breaks. And Porto Alegre refused. That is, the level of political understanding of the nature of the game that was being played meant that they decided it was not worth bribing afford by huge tax breaks to build a factory there was better, even though that was a short-term loss in the sense of jobs, to adopt whatever strategies of capital accumulation and development they could that was more centered around local resources and development possibilities. Now, that's a pretty unusual move for a city to decide it's not even going to, you know, enter into that. And the irony was that Ford actually was very interested in Porto Alegre, apparently, because it was low corruption. So there were, but Porto Alegre didn't play the game. Now, I don't know the extent to which the popular involvement in participatory budgeting meant that people's awareness and the party's awareness of possibilities locally that didn't require that interconnection with global finance. You know, they had a greater sense of what they could do locally because of that, how much that entered into, you know, that equation. But, you know, I like to think that it did, anyway.
Another paper topic.
Do you have further thoughts in light of this dialogue at this end of the internet?
I think he's gotten a lot of sleeping.
It's late there, it's okay.
You know, next week, just this will be good news for you. Next week, our time changes to summertime.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, yeah, Saturday.
On Sunday. Sunday night. This Sunday it changes.
Oh, shoot.
This Sunday it changes. So next week we will start an hour earlier for your time. Because we move up an hour. You know, so it won't be so late next year.
Next week.
And then a couple of weeks.
In fact, next year
And then a couple of weeks later, I guess you move to winter time, and we'll even be closer together.
Somehow I can
figure out where. Okay. You will be able to go for the beers 1 hour earlier. So you will be able to go for the beers 1 hour earlier.
Okay, it's 7 o'clock. But remember, next week, you have this in mind, next week, you will start 1 hour earlier than this week.
Okay.
You got it? Okay.
If you don't, no plane ticket.
And am I bringing wine?
Yes, bring them. Yeah. Bring
I'll give you a paper.
But it needs to be Argentinian wine.
Okay. Do
you have a recommendation? We're going to get some Argentine wine for next week. We will toast you.
But there's not this many weeks left in the...